G'day folks, talk to Malcolm Turnbull, a nomadic entrepreneurial para. And what I mean by that is, he's 40 years post-spinal cord injury as a paraplegic, and just the wealth of knowledge he's got within that, dealing with that, and moving forward, and the business ventures that he's been into as an entrepreneur in assistive technology, helping building up the platform for people in wheelchairs. It's done great stuff, marvellous work. And the travel ventures that he's been into over the years, trial and error, what's accessible, what's not, in Asia, in America, in our own backyard, in Australia. Great insight. Love your work, brother. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, thanks for coming down, mate. Well, I had to throw that out.
Yeah, no worries, Jake. Ex-Prime Minister.
True, actually, ex-Prime Minister.
I've got to say that name is actually, it's done me favours. Got me good restaurant seats in the eastern suburbs and got me some funny stories over the years.
Really?
Yeah.
We'll save that for later.
Yeah.
No, but really appreciate it, brother, you coming down here and just having a yarn. Just about, you know, yourself and some of the travels and business and all sorts of stuff that you've been mixed into. And
Thanks for inviting me. Yeah. It's great. Excited.
Mate, so, and, you know, what I'm excited about talking to you about, because, you know, I like getting around and traveling where I can, apart from when, you know, work's flat out and whatnot, but just your travel knowledge and just over the years, but just with yourself and your wheelchair journey, where did that all start? And
if
we just take it from there, brother.
Sure. I grew up down in the Sutherland Shire, down around the Cronulla district. Go the Sharkies, eh?
Good team. I was wondering why I've seen photos wearing you that bloody
Sharkies,
jersey.
Sharkies anyway. Jersey. I grew up down there. I grew up surfing and I don't know, I was a pretty average kind of shy guy, I guess. I loved surfing. I loved having a drink, participating in some substances that probably weren't that good for me, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, you're having a crack?
Yeah, I was having a crack, mate.
Yeah.
So anyway, 1980, myself with two other mates, went for a surfing trip up the coast. And on the way back down, we had an old mate who had moved up to Coffs Harbour. So on the way back down, we kind of dropped in to see him, and that night we went out and saw Mental as Anything up at Coffs Harbour, one of the plantation hotel up there.
Yep.
And then about 1 o'clock in the morning, someone come up with a bright idea that we should go out and do a bit of bush bashing in his Subaru and check how the waves are going. I don't know how you're going to check the waves are going at 1 o'clock in the morning. So anyway, that's what we do. We kind of went out. We went along this – back then it was all dirt track, and Paul was driving, I was in the back, I didn't have a seatbelt on. We were chucking donuts in a big paddock, I thought, and we lost control. And we started sliding, and as I was looking out the window, I could see grass, and then blackness. And I looked up and I saw Paul's face, which was pretty panicky. And I realised that we were in a bit of trouble. And next thing I know, we're free falling over a 20-metre cliff. Macaulay's Headland, which came to an abrupt end at the bottom of the rocks. And it was weird. The two guys in the front really miraculously got out scot-free. So they went off to get help. They took them about 5-6 hours to get back with some help. Myself and another guy, Pete, my best mate, was in the back. I don't know how, but I knew I'd broken my back straight away. I got no idea. Pete was unconscious for a while. He got out of the car and come around and said, "Hey, Mal, I'll pull you out." I said, "No, don't move me. I've broken my back." And
You just knew, yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't feel my legs. you know, and I had this kind of burning sensation. I found out later I had broken ribs with a punctured lung. It was the weirdest kind of experience. And we lay there with waves splashing up on us, hoping the tide wasn't coming in.
Jeez.
And then eventually you got there, and I kind of had this feeling that my legs were sticking straight out in front of me, but when they were pulling me out, I looked down and my legs were kind of tucked in completely, like nowhere where I'd imagine they'd be.
Yeah.
So anyway, look, a long story short, we got to Coffs Harbour Hospital. They did x-rays, and within an hour, one of the local doctors came in and said, hey, you're never going to walk again.
Mm.
So it was pretty clear early in my journey that there was no chance of walking.
Yep.
And the next day they flew me down in a light plane, and I ended up at Prince of Henry Hospital back in 1980.
Yeah. And how was it like being a young fella and just the physicality of it, but a lot to do with, you know, the mental game and just, you know, just trying to adjust to, being someone with a spinal cord injury.
Look, you've been through it, you know. Mm. So first of all, I was 8 weeks in bed, pretty much immobile.
Mm. Yeah.
So during that time, lost a lot of weight. I was desperate to get out of bed. You know what it's like. Then I get out of bed, and I've been up for about 5 seconds. I was like, put me back to bed. I'm just too dizzy.
Yeah.
I vividly remember the first time I got up and I was able to stay up for, you know, any period of time. And I went into the bathroom and there was a mirror there, and I saw myself in the mirror and I kind of broke down. I was like, that can't be me, because, you know, I went in there. I was a fit, healthy guy. I was suntanned. I was looking like I was a skeleton, white ghost. I was really fortunate. There was two other guys in there who were about the same age, about the same injuries. So we kind of competed with each other. Yeah.
Good support network in there, yeah.
Yep. But the emotional stuff was, you know, like your whole life's changed, right?
Mm.
Like I had to, like everything I'd been in the past was gone. You know, I'm 40 years post-injury. I still think of myself as a surfer. But I didn't surf anymore.
That's weird too, because I have like dreams where if I'm still skateboarding as an able-bodied person, like I will have dreams where, yeah, I'm in a chair, but it's still of what was.
Yeah.
And, it's tough.
Yeah. So there's a couple of other guys about the same age, same injury as me. So we kind of got alongside and we'd push each other.
Mm.
Yeah. But I was really fortunate. I had an OT who was this Prue. She was a great OT, right? And she worked with me, and she worked out what motivated me. And as a 19-year-old kid from the suburbs, you know, what motivated me was beer. So she kind of did this great stuff. I often reflect on how great she was. She said, okay, today what we're going to – this is going to be rehab today.
This right? is a great incentive. I like this.
Oh, man. She said, this is how we're going to do rehab today, right?
Yeah.
You're going to get dressed, and then we're going to push down. So out at Prince Henry Hospital, we're on this big spread of the coast, and right down the bottom of the hill – so Ward 1 was up the top of the hill. Right down the bottom of the hill was the golf club. So what we're going to do, we're going to push down there. You're going to have to go up a couple of gutters here and there and over a bit of grass and down a few hills, and then you're going to have to push up, and that's going to be hard work. But when we get to the golf club, you can have a beer or two. So that was it, you know. She worked out, okay, pretty hard to get motivated, but you'll kind of do a lot for a beer. So she kind of designed this rehab around that stuff, which was fantastic.
And designing the route of getting to the golf club as well, like was it a bit tough and trying to find the balance of how
– Absolutely.
Like with core and all that sort of stuff? Like.
Yeah, man, we're going down. So I'm a T5 para, so I've got no core muscles. Mm. Back in those days, the wheelchairs we had were big folding metalite chairs. They weighed like 55 pounds. Work it out in kilos, I don't know, 20, 22 kilos or whatever.
Yeah.
They were massive, you know. There was no custom-made chairs. They were just massive things. So you had to try and get up on your back wheels going down some of these steep little hills. She'd take me over grass. She'd take me over little curbs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it was a real challenge. It was really – and it was good because it wasn't the ideal kind of environment that you get in a hospital setting. It was the outside stuff, right?
And just thinking of those chairs, you're saying on the back wheel, did you have anti-tippers back then on the chairs?
Nah, no anti-tippers, man. But seriously, the chairs that we had, my first chair, I used to be able to lean out the back and get my whole ass off the cushion and pull my pants up. Like, they would not tip over backwards. They were so heavy to push. But they were stable as.
Yeah, so, but they would have built up the shoulders, like, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a whole lot.
Yes and no.
They build up your shoulders, but you do a whole lot of damage because the chairs weren't, like, built around you and they were heavy and they were inefficient, all that kind of stuff.
So. Yeah. So how'd that process go, just going from the start of the rehabilitation journey to getting back home? And also, if you want to talk us through that, like, how was that journey? And it sounds like you had a good support network with these fellas, but was it pretty competitive too? Like, in a way?
Yeah, we were really
competitive. Because you sound like a pretty competitive bloke, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I definitely kind of looking at what – so there was two guys in particular, a guy Warren and a guy David. So David was about the same level injury as me, and Warren was like an L1 or something, you know. So so we pushed each other. You know, how far can you do a wheel stand? What can you get up the gutter? Can you get the floor to the seat? All that kind of stuff. And that was important. Like you said, I played football. I said, like, league as a kid, surfed, did all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
So there was a competitive side of me that just challenged me and thought, okay, if they can do it, I must be able to do it.
Right? That's great.
Which was really important for me. But that whole journey, and in saying that, like, I do not want to underestimate the impact of a spinal cord injury on someone, right?
Mm.
As I said before, I was a young kid from the suburbs. I'd had very little to do with disability, you know, growing up. I had an aunt who was a great aunt who was who had Down syndrome.
Yep. Yeah.
And one of my uncles was a polio survivor who had opened up the house with no steps or been instrumental in that stuff.
Yeah, right.
So that was the extent of what I knew as disability. So coming out of hospital back then, I got kicked out of hospital because I was pretty non-compliant, that word. So then I end up with this going. They used to come and pick us up and they'd take us into Camperdown, and there was a rehab in there called QE2. So it was like a day post-hospital.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So a kid from the Shire, I get chucked in. It was mind-boggling for me because in that rehab there was, you know, thalidomide survivors with no arms or no legs. There was people with brain injury, acquired brain injury. There was cerebral palsy. There was, like, everything.
It was the whole mix.
The whole mix.
Yeah.
And when I first went in there, it was like, oh, man, this is really confronting.
Yeah.
It didn't take me long to get to the stage where I went, oh, man, I love these people. You know, they've got this shared brokenness that we have.
Mm.
They're struggling with kind of life.
Yeah. All they're in my the kind same of people. All in the same struggle but different, but, you know, if you can get in there and if it's helping out each other and, like you're saying, like, everybody's competitive, it doesn't matter if
– Yeah.
Like, and it's hard, like, the mental side of it, but it doesn't matter on your disability if you can bring out that little bit of competitive drive to get better in some sort of fashion or way.
Absolutely.
You know, it's going to help you pump along, you know.
And the other thing did it stripped away this kind of stigma of disability and helped me to see them as humans who were just great people. I mean, just amazing people. So it was like, for me, it was like, oh, man, it was really enabling and really kind of encouraging for me to see that. In a lot of ways, I kind of aspired to be like what they were, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I often think about this,
Jake. What, just seeing the strength with
just
some of the people
inner
that...
strength, inner strength and inner joy, you know? We kind of... A lot of times people think, as a society, I think we kind of project what we think is the external ideal, and that's when people will be happy.
Yeah.
And my experience is that's not the case. You know, I'm continually meeting people who, you know, seem much less worse off than me, who just have this inner joy and happiness that I aspire to. I'd love to have what they have, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's
And like, so how, just thinking of rehabilitation units from back then, so going from back then to now, like, because you've would have seen it a bit, and especially you being down in Sydney, where a lot of the like New South Wales based rehabilitation units are, when you got Prince of Wales and then you got Royal Ride Rehab, so and where they hone in on spinal cord injury. So how would you compare to what they are now to what they were back then when you were going through that situation?
Oh, mate, it's chalk and cheese, you know. Like, we were, in a lot of ways, like 1980, we were not that far away. Well, 1980 was the year that the day of people with disabilities was actually put in place. I think it was 1980, if I'm not wrong. So all this whole disability kind of thing was pretty new back then. So, not pretty new, but there was quite a few people who had kind of paved a way for us back in the States and here. I just think of guys like Chris Barks, or Errol Hyde, or Nick Morozov. There was a few people that had just paved these ways for us.
So other people in chairs or various disabilities?
Other
or?
People in chairs and various disabilities.
Yep.
Yeah. So back then, rehab was really, was pretty basic. Yeah. Yep. You kind of did weights.
Yep.
You try a bit of archery, you know, drag you along, try a little bit of wheelchair basketball, see how it goes.
Yeah, and did they have the basketball chairs back then?
No, we were all pushing around in fold-up chairs, man. You'd kind of fall out of your chair and the whole chair would fold up and fall on top of you, all that kind of stuff. It was crazy. Now you look at, Royal Rehab, it's a remarkable institution, and you've got places like Sargoods where you can go and try. So if I had had my injury today, I would have kept surfing because I would have gone to Sargoods. The guys out there would have got me out in a surf and I would have gone, hey, man, I can go surfing.
Yeah.
That wasn't an option way back then in 1980. And just as a way of landscape, when I had my accident and moved back to Cronulla, or to the Shire, I could get on at Cronulla Station, which was railway station, but there was a step, like, you know, really high. I hope you can see that.
Yep.
To get onto there. I could get off at Miranda Station and I could get off at Town Hall if it was on a particular platform. And then I had to go up this escalator that was from the very bottom up the top.
Right.
So there was no buses that were accessible.
Yeah.
Half the places, or not half the places.
And the buses are still a bit, how's it going? I've been on some of the buses these days and, you know, because you're not locked in and you just, as soon as they hit a hard corner, you're sliding out, you know.
Yeah. It's all right if you got all your balance and stuff. Right?
Yeah.
So I think the rehab, like the rehab stuff has changed a lot, yeah. But the other thing that I found really interesting was the rehab was really functional. So it was, okay, can Mal get dressed? Tick. Yeah. Can he transfer in and out of his chair? Tick. Can he shower? Tick. Yeah, it was all these functional kind of stuff, and then you go. So I left hospital, man. I was still trying to figure out what's it mean to be a man, you know. Like my whole kind of idea of being a man had changed. I wasn't surfing, I wasn't football, and I wasn't, you know, having sex up against a wall somewhere or whatever you want to, whatever we kind of label on a, on masculinity. So I had to kind of examine, hey, who am I as a person?
Just trying to find where do you fit in with the rest of society.
Absolutely. And with myself, and trying to come to grips with, you know, the whole kind of bladder and bowel stuff and the shame around having accidents and, you know, getting agoraphobic, going for an agoraphobic time where I was scared to go out in case I had a bowel problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably lasted for a couple of years.
Yeah.
All that stuff is just, so I got to start, and I medicated.
But it's good you say, like, talking about this stuff, because
it's really important.
There's so many other people that are in similar situations, just where they're scared to go out the front door just in case something happens, you know, but.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know I'm not unique in that experience. And I couldn't, you know, 40 years ago I couldn't have had this conversation because there's something about bodily functions that's really shameful, hey? And it shouldn't be.
Doesn't matter if you're in a chair or not.
Yeah, but I couldn't separate. That was just my body doing.
Yep.
Apart from, you know, I couldn't separate that from me being somehow as a person.
Yep.
You know, not right or something, I don't know. So so all that stuff, but I also medicated. I used a lot of substances in my first 10 years to deal with what was going on with me, with my life, right? And on the outside, I did a mechanical engineering course. I was the first person to do that at UTS as a wheelchair user. I worked at the water board in the computer sciences or computer programming for 7-8 years.
Nice.
But in the background, I was on methadone for about four years. I was using whatever I could get my hands on. I reached rock bottom in 1990, where I actually ended up going into a rehab to get clean, to clean myself up. And coming out of there, I thought, you know, there's something. I need to talk to someone about this whole disability stuff. So I rang up the spinal board, said, I don't think I'm coping with my disability all that well. This is 10 years post-injury, right?
Yeah.
And they went through that functional list. Can you get dressed? Yeah, yeah. Can you drive? Yeah. Can you do this? Blah, blah. They said, there's nothing we can help you with. So that whole kind
really?
Of...
Really?
Yeah, that whole kind of...
See, and that's... If it's got to do with, like, the mental struggle of a person when it's got to do with, you know, disability or, you know, mental health issues, there's a lot of stigma and stuff still to this day,
absolutely.
You know? And then it's... And you're talking about back then and trying to find the resources to do it, so...
Yeah, yeah.
So what happened? Like, they've gone, no, we don't have anything, so who would you have a yarn with?
Mm. So what happened coming out of that rehab, and I started to have a look at that sort of stuff. I tried the hospital, couldn't do it. So I started seeing a psychologist for a while. But I also looked around and I realised after 10 years post-injury, I had no friends who were wheelchair users. And I thought, that's a bit bizarre, you know. What I did, I thought, okay, what I'm going to do, I'm going to start playing. I'm going to go out and have a look at wheelchair basketball. Not because I want to play basketball. I have no interest in basketball, really.
Yeah.
I just want to go out there and have a look because that's what wheelchair people do, isn't it? They play wheelchair basketball. Like, where else do you meet people in wheelchairs?
Yeah, it's one of the main staple sports.
Yeah.
And were the chairs better, though?
No, oh yeah, they'd improved a lot 10 years down the track.
Oh, 10 years,
so
right?
So again, I'll chuck a bit of a heads out. There was a guy, Michael Callahan, who had his accident about the same time, who started a company called Action Wheelchairs, and now it's called Mogo. His son.
Oh, Mogo,
son's still carrying on the business. Sadly, RIP Mick died last year. But he came out of hospital and there was Mick and there was a few other guys, guy Bill Dusseldorf and Nick Morozov. But probably...
Because I remember him because when I was in Royal Ride, when I had my accident, I remember him scooting in and out of the rehab. You know, this is 11 years ago now, but...
Mick is a great guy. And so he started making First of all, people started cutting all the metal lights up and re-welding them.
And that's what I wanted to jump into. That's what fascinates me, just the evolution of, say, it's something that you might have an idea, like let's fabricate X, Y, and Z to make me spin quicker, or if it's going to adjust to my, because I don't have any core, so let's do this. So, yeah, take us through some of that.
I'll tell you it's a great story, because what happened was guys like Michael Callahan, Bill Doodledoffen, Nick Morozov, Mike Dempsey, an American guy, there was a whole lot of these wheelchair users who were coming through. Yeah.
Is that Mike, not Mike from Tennessee?
Yeah,
That was over here for a while?
It could have been, I don't know. Yeah, Mike Dempsey was an amazing guy. He was the first person that designed that cantilever, the monoframe design.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And he, as a wheelchair user, was ranked in the top 10 table tennis players in America, regardless of disability.
So, really?
Yeah, he was an incredible guy, right? But these guys, so we were coming out of rehab back then with those old junky chairs.
Mm.
And Mick Callahan was an ex-miner, had his accident mining. So he was really handy with a welding gun and fabricating and stuff.
And understood metals and weights and the types that you use, yeah?
So he starts building these chairs out of aluminium. They were aspirational back then, you know. But, yeah, they just revolutionised. And all of a sudden, these rigid frame chairs, not the folding chairs, had started coming on, and people started building those, and they were lighter, they were more rigid, and they were more manoeuvrable.
Mm.
And Mick was great. Mick could sort of measure you up and pretty much design the chair around you. And as he got into the whole process, he got to know what worked for different levels of injury. And if you look at the history of, assistive technology in this field, a lot of it has been driven by end users who just saw a need for something and started doing it. And there was this real sense of entrepreneurship, like back in the 80s and 90s. People who maybe couldn't get work in standard jobs, but saw these niches like building wheelchairs or whatever.
Trying to find a way.
Yeah, yeah. So trying to find a way, trying to make life better for wheelchair users. I started working in around about that time, 1990, 91, I started working in a company called Dynamic Living Designs, which was owned at that time by three wheelchair users, a guy Chris Sparks, Nick Morozov and Rob King.
What, and they're all wheelchair users?
They're all wheelchair users.
Nice.
Yeah. And what had happened, Nick and Chris had the opportunity to travel overseas, and they came back and they'd seen all these great products over there, and their whole vision was, hey, we want to make these products available to Australian wheelchair users. So that kind of, they weren't the only one. There was other companies. So,
and trying to build them here instead of trying to import stuff.
Not necessarily. We were importing a lot of stuff. A lot of the good stuff was coming out of America,
right?
Or Europe. And that's just by economy of scales. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah, true.
But you look at, you look at Tylite. Tylite started with a couple of end users going to a guy who ran a titanium factory.
Yep.
Or a titanium supplier going, I think we can make really great wheelchairs out of titanium. We've got some ideas around design.
Yeah.
And how to make that work. So again, a Marty Balls and Jim Blacks and Josh Andersons, those kind of guys come in. They drove that stuff,
And now you got carbon fibre in the mix as well.
Unreal. Yeah, the materials that are coming out and the way that stuff changes. But what's really weird, right, is a wheelchair is still a wheelchair.
Yeah.
So, still just got four wheels. But what's changed is just that thing of being custom made, being more rigid, more efficient, all that kind of stuff.
So you've been in the coalface of this, right, and seeing, being with all the end users, a lot of these companies are run by people in chairs and using manufacturing and getting this stuff out there and measuring up, but how were the allied health professionals behind this? Because they'd be really taking note of what's going on. And when you're talking, especially occupational therapists, so what was their outlook and how did they help you? How did you help them? Like, how did all that sort of roll into, because that's, I'm just thinking of the progression of that, you know?
It's really interesting. So going back, if I go back to that basketball, starting to play wheelchair basketball, so all of a sudden I'm like, it's funny because I turned up, right, and I'm a guy from the inner west who's got his own issues. So I turn up, I've got Doc Martens on, and I've got like a black pair of jeans with a studded belt on, and I'm looking all goth, right? So I turn up and all these guys
looking
are
looking all
their,
goth. Yeah.
All these guys are in their tracksuits and doing all that sort of stuff. You know, they're looking like sports people.
And now he's Marilyn Manson cruising along in his chair.
So they quickly called me the alt sport. He's now the alt sport, right? The alternative sportsman. But what happened is again, I met all these great people like Jerry Hewson's and I don't know, I could name millions of them, yeah. And we started talking about all that stuff. Like, how do you manage your bladder? How do you manage your bowel? What are you doing with women? You know, how are you getting upstairs? How are you getting downstairs? What are you doing for wheelchair? What cushion are you using?
And do you find when you haven't, like, and you would have had over the years, like, even if you don't know, you've known this person for 5 minutes, that's in a chair, but these conversations start coming out?
We're at a base level.
I know, I've had that level, stuff. It's
And
yeah.
There's no need to put a screen up.
No.
Because we know it. We know it shits us.
Yeah.
We know there are issues that we all face.
Yeah. And have you always, or have you also seen, like I've had this where, like the majority of the time I'm talking to other wheelchair users, like people that have, you know, had an accident, whatever, it's quad, para, whatever it may be, and you're having these conversations and all of this stuff's coming out where, you know, the shield's down, everything's flowing. But then you get some people with chairs, like, you know, when you're out and about, you might be wheeling and someone else is there and it's another person in a chair and it's, you know, give a bit of a nod, you know.
Yeah.
We're in the same boat. But you get other people that are in chairs, they just don't want to associate themselves with other chair users or disability. Like, people still hold up those walls, you know.
Mate, it's something I've contemplated a lot over the years is, you know, let's be frank, you know, there's a group of people who have spinal cord injuries and somehow work through it and go on and have, I've had a great life, you know. You know, despite all the crap that's happened to you, you're living a great life in a lot of ways, right? Doesn't mean it's easy or nothing like that, but we've got purpose, we know we can contribute a bit, we know where we belong, we know we can change, all that kind of stuff, right? And for some reason, I don't know what it is, genetics, upbringing, you know, whatever, luck, I don't know. Some of us seem to move through that and get to a stage. For me, it was getting to a stage where I want to have as good a life as I can possibly have, and to do that, I need to focus on what I can do, not what I can't do. Yeah, that was pretty much my deep decision. Yeah, whereas other people just don't seem to be able to cope with that. They just don't seem to ever be able to get over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what I really don't know. I don't think I'm a particularly special person, and somehow I'm, you know, better than other people for that. I don't know. I just don't know what the magic formula is.
Yeah, and I'm the same too, like, you know, because everybody's got their different struggles.
We've all got our own demons.
That's it, being in a chair or not. But, like, and it's with me, like, you know, you still get your down days and your positive ones. But, you know, with me in a chair, I'm like, it's something that I won't get used to, but it's just something I've got to deal with.
Yeah.
And just taking it day by day and just getting up and having a crack the best that you can, you know.
It's something that it's me having a spinal cord injury, I've got no control over. I cannot change it. Doesn't matter how much I don't want it, it's not going to change,
right?
So until I can accept that, I just can't move forward. Yeah, and so I kind of diverse. So I was going back to that wheelchair sports stuff.
Yeah, back in the basketball. Yeah.
So I learnt bucket loads from my peers. Yeah, and we started travelling, doing sort of wheelchair things together. I started working with Nick and Chris Sparks at Dynamic Living Designs. We got really close. We scripted all our own chairs. Like, the only OT that ever scripted my chair was in 1980, and it was the first chair I ever got. Up until the NDIS, where now I need to get an OT to sign off on a form, I had never had an OT do anything in my life.
Really?
True story.
So
for 38 years, I married an OT. I love OTs and they do great stuff. But up until for 38 years, people who scripted my chairs were other wheelchair users or myself once I got confident with it. And we did a lot of that work, you know, through DLD and through other. And through that process, we worked with a lot of OTs as well. So it hasn't always. Not everyone has that experience. Obviously, most people are going to be in partnership with a therapist of some sort to get that stuff down.
And talking about the partnership and getting that stuff down. So, were they chasing you guys and girls like for the knowledge of like certain wheelchairs and how to script and. Because they have their own, but at the end of the day, they're not the ones that are sitting in chairs and knowing how this physically operates as an end user.
The environment's changed heaps, Jake. So if I go back again to, say, 1980 through to 2000, particularly with manual chairs, not so much with power chairs, but with manual chairs, if I look, because I got involved in the assistive technology, I worked with DLD and then we started a company that was actually distributing gear. So we worked with suppliers all over Australia.
And is that what's led you into the business of that, just you finding that niche of, say, because you can't get work in certain other places and it's like, I want to sort of get in and give other wheelchair users the sort of same playing field as...
Mate, I had jobs up until 1990 outside of assistive technology, and I've had job offers from outside of that industry over the years that I haven't taken up.
Yeah.
When I started playing wheelchair basketball and I started getting involved with Dynamic Living Designs and this industry, I just got passionate about it. I could see that we were making a difference in people's lives.
Yep.
You'd go out, you'd see people who were just struggling to live, and we'd get them the right equipment, and their lives changed.
Passion and purpose.
Oh, man, so much. And I've been fortunate. You talked about travelling. I've been really fortunate to travel. I mean, I travelled to over 41 countries. So that stuff of just somehow that you know, I can be used to maybe help someone else understand that there's life after spinal cord injury, or seeing just what a difference assistive technology makes and how life opens up. I mean, it's a great feeling. It's better than any profit I've ever made. I never got much satisfaction out of looking at P&Ls and balance sheets. What I got great satisfaction out of was going to bed at night going, man, we made a difference in someone's life today.
Yeah, yeah.
What a privilege, right, to be in people's lives.
Yeah.
And to be able to contribute. And it's not all me given, man. I mean, like, you know, I've been a recipient of all this stuff over the years as well. So it's kind of like, I just got caught up in the passion of it. I still am really passionate about disability, and I've been thinking about it just recently. You know, my wife and I moved up from Sydney up to Morisset a few years ago, and I was thinking, what would it be like to wake up in the morning and know that if I go up to Morisset Shopping Centre, I can get into 100% of the shops instead of the 5% that I can get into. What would it be like to say, hey, Shalish, let's go spend a weekend somewhere, and to be able to just jump in the car and drive without doing any planning and knowing that we're going to find a hotel that we can stay in without having to make 100 calls trying to clarify, even if they say they've got a wheelchair accessible room, trying to clarify what does that mean in your book.
Well, that's it. You get there and they say accessible and you're like, right, there's a hob in the shower. Okay, that bed's not really in the right position. The door widths, like, that stuff happens all the time. Like, just being a wheelchair user and just the methodical steps you've got to go through before you leave the front, go out the bloody front door.
All that planning. And generally you've got to stay in the most expensive hotel. So, you know, all you name it, what would it be like to live in a world where all those barriers just weren't there? And the other thing I think about a lot is,
if it was Sargood, but a whole suburb of it.
The whole world of Sargood.
Yeah.
How good would that be? And the NDIS is great. I think the vision of the NDIS is fantastic.
It is, and it's getting better.
And I also think about this a lot, Jake, and I don't know how you feel about this, but as a spinal cord injury, I feel like I feel like I'm kind of like almost the most fortunate in the disability sector.
Yeah.
Because I can communicate, I've had a good education. My brain works pretty normal, depending on who you speak to. I'm just a guy sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
All that kind of. But imagine having like something hidden like a mental illness.
Oh.
Yeah.
Or
that communication problems of that a lot of people with cerebral palsy
I think about that stuff a lot too. Like even, me being like for work being an NDIS service provider and seeing the different types of disabilities and where if you do have that psychosocial or intellectual or mental health side of things when it comes to disability and just the struggles of that and how that it can impact all sorts of stuff to do with you physically. Even where I might think, I'm pretty fortunate, like even with my level of injury and the position that I'm in, and what I do, but, what happens if it's someone like me, like physically, but in some remote community where they don't have X, Y, and Z service provision or the right type of chairs, or they're in some country where they just don't have access to anything,
Totally. And for me, the extension, when I think of myself like that, I feel like I've got a responsibility to be an advocate for disability.
100%, brother.
And what you're saying now, I've done a lot of travel. As I said, I've done a lot of travel. Couple of countries, like I've travelled through India and I've travelled through extensively through Thailand.
Yeah, and when did that all start? When you were a young fella or?
No, interesting, yeah.
And I'll drink too.
Yeah, just before we go down, I'll talk a little bit about the travel. But
That's it.
Going to places like Thailand, up into the remote areas, and seeing people up there who have got spinal cord injuries or other disabilities and the lack of resources they have is just, it's mind-boggling how fortunate and how it's kind of like a privileged, I can't have any other word for it, privileged, I am to live the life I live through no merit of my own. I just happen to be born in a country where things are freaking great.
Circumstance,
Yeah, absolutely. So so my travel stuff. So early on in my life as a wheelchair user, right, probably 92, 93.
Yep.
I was really struggling with that whole stuff of who am I, what can I do, what can't I do. So I made a decision. I had an old Holden at that stage. I had some friends in Melbourne. I had an old mate in who'd moved to Glenelg in
Adelaide. Yeah.
So I made a decision I was going to go on a road trip, right? I was going to drive down to Melbourne and then drive along the Great Ocean Road and then come up to Adelaide and then come up through the interior.
And what tech were you using in your car, assistive tech to drive, did you have?
We had push-pull hand controls.
You did?
Back
okay.
Then. Yeah, so yep. We had that stuff. Although I could tell you some stories from hospital about driving with walking sticks and or one person on the floor doing the accelerator brake while the other person's steering saying, hey, brake, no. It's like, brake now. But anyway, so I did that and that was really – so, you know, I slept in the car a bit and I kind of used public toilets along the way and did all that sort of stuff. And
just trying to find out what works, what doesn't. Just exploring.
Man, what can I do? What can I can't do? You know, what's going to happen? And I tell you, like bad shit happens when I travel. There's no guarantee that everything's going to go smoothly.
But was it empowerment for you though? Shit, this don't work.
Yeah.
What have I got to do to sort of rectify this problem and sort stuff out?
It was hugely empowering for me. Mm. I was like, okay, because I did a whole lot of problem solving, and I managed to do what I did. So that was the beginning, I guess, of this kind of little bit of traveling. But my real travel bug started. I started playing wheelchair basketball in '95. Someone from England was looking for a So without going into details, in wheelchair basketball, you're classified on your functionality.
Yep.
So I've got the least function that you can have when you're playing wheelchair basketball. So I'm classified as a one-pointer.
Yeah.
So there was a team in England that
got to do with your core and stuff, yeah?
Yep. So basically, the highest point you can be is 4.5. So the more function you've got, the more points you've got, down to the most disabled, for want of another word, which was me as a one-pointer. But anyway, there's a guy over in a wheelchair basketball team in England. We're looking for a one-pointer to come and play a season or two over there. So I decided that I'd do that. So I jump on this plane.
Is this the first time shooting overseas?
I've been overseas once before.
Okay.
The most terrifying experience of my life. But because...
Before we go into the England trip, tell us, like, first time on a plane, getting prepped up, leading to that, terrified.
Oh, man, so
terrified.
What was
that like? Because I know I was shitting myself the first time I did it.
So my first trip was overseas was 1982. My eldest brother, I don't know what happened in my family. My two eldest brothers and my younger sister and my brother are highly intelligent guys, right? So somehow I don't know, maybe I was adopted or something, I don't know. But my eldest brother Ian was doing a PhD under scholarship in Cambridge University.
Cambridge, nice.
King's College. So my sister and I decide that we're going to travel over there and visit England, right? So I'm, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years post-injury.
Still fresh.
I've still got the stupid fold-up chair, and I'm using leg bags with Eurodones at that stage, and it's like, so I am terrified, you know. It's like my greatest fear still is having a bowel accident on an aeroplane. I tell you what, that first trip I didn't eat for about 3 days before the trip. And I didn't eat on the whole plane trip over there. You know, I drank. I kind of dehydrated myself. I've got, you know, I'm trying to work out my medications and, you know, I'm on baclofen and friggin' whatever it was else and trying to make sure I've got all that in.
So you're trying to risk mitigate as much as possible.
And what's going to happen if I get there and, you know, they stop me at customs and just everything. What about accommodation, you know? Like, I don't – like, what are we going to do for accommodation if there's no wheelchair access? It was seriously, I can't imagine like someone like Captain Cook in 1770 being any scareder of jumping on his boat and sailing around Australia than I was on jumping on this plane and going to England. It was terrified. I was terrified of it.
Who'd you fly with? It.
Qantas from memory.
Yeah, Qantas.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I mean, this is 1982 or whatever. Mm. I smoked cigarettes back then. There was no smoking on the plane, so I had to go like, I don't know, it was like 14 hours and then 12 hours without a cigarette. Even that seemed impossible. Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
It would have been itching.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's crazy. But, yeah, I was absolutely terrified. And we get to England and it was Christmas of 19, must have been 82, I think, because there was only four white Christmases.
Oh, she's snowing over there.
It's snowing, man. It was snowing like you wouldn't believe. We're in Caribbean black ice, right? Oh. And my sister, God love her.
Did you have good tread on the wheelchair?
No, man, you end up like pushing along and you end up like trying to stop and, well, you know, just hitting a wall somewhere and going, okay, that's the
black
that's
eyes.
Only way you can stop. And, you know, we would push around and I would have like, you know, snow up to the armpits and then we'd go into the pub and we'd sit near the fire and by the end of the, by the time I'd had a couple of pints, there'd be like a 3 meter diameter puddle around where I'd sat, all that kind of stuff. But it was like coming home was equally as scary on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so glad I did it because it opened up this kind of thing in my mind that, you know, maybe the only barriers I've got are my own fears. And if I can confront those fears, we can make it work. You
that's
know?
Why I throw that in, mate. Taste the fear, brother. Fear.
Absolutely, and it's true, right? You know, that's that old saying that courage is not a lack of fear. Courage is doing stuff despite the fear.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's so true because it's kind of natural that that's going to be a scary thing to do, right?
Yeah, it's but, man, dipping it's your so toes worth and just grabbing those little bits of experience here and there that, you know, help up build your resilience, whether you're skidding on black ice in wintertime over in England and, or, you know, or whatever you may be traveling, you know, through Asia.
Oh, man.
In a wheelchair. When did you? We'll jump into that because I'm just Asia and wheelchairs and I'm thinking of accessibility, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Yeah. So the other thing is I had great mentors, right? So Chris and Nick that I talked about before had travelled a lot and they came up with these great stories, right? So Chris Barks has been a wheelchair user since he was 3 years old. He's got arms that are about 20 foot long or, you know, 5 metres long, you know. Yeah. He's kind of like got these huge arms. Nick was a ballet dancer pre-accident. Yeah.
I met Nick. And this was – he was an inspiration to me because he was one of the – because you'd have people that would come through the rehab at Ride and he was still crook when he come through. But despite him going through his illness, just his character and just what he was trying to inspire to – us other people with spinal cord injuries and talking us through his travel expertise and his dancing and what he could do within a wheelchair and trying to show able-bodied people what people with spinal cord injuries could do and the bloody rock climbing.
Mm.
Like this guy's dragging himself up a mountain with his chair tied to him.
Mm.
And then would throw the chair up, drag himself, get in the chair, and then went wheel back down the mountain. Insane. And I'll forever remember that.
I'll get all teary, but Nick, we were in business together. We were good mates. We were really good mates. Mm. He was the eternal optimist, the most optimistic guy.
Yeah.
To a fault, you know. We used to joke, we wish we lived in Nickland. I've met amazing people over my life from all sorts of walks of life. No one has inspired me as much as Nick. And being alongside Nick during his illness with his wife Alison, his two kids, Sasha and Lara, was just, anyway, there's, I don't know how to put it into words, you know. I miss him on a day-to-day basis, yeah. He was, you know, he's one of those guys that if you wrote a book about Nick's life as and he had been an able-bodied person, you would have said, that's amazing.
Mm.
The fact that he did what he did as a wheelchair user was incredible. I mean, Nick...
I'm still astounded by, you know, I'm just thinking of the silhouette of what they got at Royal Road Rehab of him hanging off that mountain with a chair.
I was working at DLD when Nick came in. Nick had that photo taken, right?
It's insane.
And Nick, it was a beautiful photo. Now, Nick had an ego, right? And I was a bit of a dick. So Nick came in, he's got that photo and he's going, man, look at this photo. How fantastic is it? And I looked at it and went, yeah, that's all right, Nick. He said, no, Mal, look at it. Look at it. How good's the photo? I'm going, yeah, that's pretty, it's okay, you know, it's okay. And it drove him crazy, but it is an incredible photo and it won all sorts of awards that year for the great photos.
Yeah.
So anyway, look, we could do a podcast, a separate podcast just on what him. Nick did, mate. Chris Barks in there because Chris was his closest friend. And Chris loved Nick and Nick loved Chris. You know, he could tell stories about Nick. And one of the stories they told with this travel stuff, this is where I started with Nick, was they'd been, I think it was in Paris. Sorry if I'm wrong, Chris. They'd been in Paris and
Were you there with them or no?
No, okay. They were just telling me this story.
Yeah, right.
So they were in Paris, right? And they're in this... hotel that's got a lift, but it'll only fit one. You could only get into the lift by getting onto the ground and pulling your chair in after you, so that the chair was folded up or whatever, right?
What?
So they would get in there, they'd both get on the ground and then they'd fold the chairs up, pull it up, and Chris would just press the button.
Reach up and bang, yeah.
So they told the story of one day... Nick went back without Chris, got into the elevator and realised his arms weren't long enough to push the button.
He was stuck.
Chris's. So, you know, those kind of stories were like, oh, man, that was just funny. And and I realised, like, all sorts of stuff happened over the years. So my first trip to Asia, I had this friend, Karan Bhatia, who's an Indian guy, right? So he says, let's go to India. And I'm like, yeah, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So we got in, we get to New Delhi, and then Karan was local, he had family there. His mum lived up in the foothills of the Himalayas in this little place called Missouri.
Yeah, okay.
So anyway, we're hanging around in New Delhi, and the access is crap, but we're getting by and, you know.
And when's this? So I take us back year-wise.
This is 94.
Right, 94. Yeah.
So anyway, Karan and I get a bit sick of each other's company, so it's like, oh. Karan says, why don't you go down to Rajasthan, right? I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So he organises this car for me, right? So I'm in this car with this guy who speaks two-fifths of no English and I speak no Hindi. And we're driving from New Delhi down to Rajasthan.
And how were the locals like, if they're seeing you're in a wheelchair and you're able and getting around as much as you can, how were the locals taking that? And what, like, I'm just thinking of the respect levels. Like,
okay, it really great question. So India, you've got like a billion people, right? Their idea of social space is totally, totally different to ours.
Yeah.
And their access is crap. So try and find a toilet over there that had access. No way. So I'm out in these places, you know, and I can't get to a get to a bathroom. I'm trying to find somewhere that's as private as possible. By that stage, I'm self-catheterizing, right?
Right.
So
right.
as private as possible. Mm. There's all sorts of germs and shit around. Yeah. Like, it's like, you know, it's the most unhygienic kind of environment.
People with spinal cord injuries and UTIs, like
all that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to find these private places. So I'd be there, and I've got no choice. I've got to catheterize.
Mm-hmm.
So I swear I'm sitting in these places, and I've got like 100 Indian people standing around me, just watching me do what I'm doing, just looking. And I've got no choice. I'm just doing this stuff, and I would love to have heard the conversations when they got home that night. Right? You know what they saw. And it was really fascinating because I think what they thought was, hey, there's this European guy in a wheelchair traveling. He must be really rich, yeah?
Mm.
And I remember going to Mahatma Gandhi's grave, yeah? And there was a group of Indian locals in these really ancient kind of wheelchairs. They were spinal cord injuries. They were getting pushed around. And I remember them just sitting and their jaws kind of dropping when they saw me wheeling past.
Right.
You know, just being independent.
Yeah, right. And this is just local mob that are in their chairs that you'd be wheeling. Like, you didn't know they were there. Like, no. You'd be wheeling past them. They see you in your gear and what you're capable of, and they're like, geez.
So these guys, they had actually come to to visit Mahatma Gandhi's grave, right?
Okay.
They were there as a group.
Yep.
Yeah. Out on the streets, you didn't see wheelchair users. What you saw was people who were in these, they were like chairs.
Is that because
with a bike?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Is that because they'd be like, if it's like a social structure sort of thing, if people in chairs are better off in out of sight, out of mind sort of thing? Like, is it like that? I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there.
This was 94.
Because I've heard some cultures are like that in certain countries.
I don't know India well enough to give an informed opinion on it.
Okay.
My feeling is more that they just didn't have resources. You just didn't have resources. Where do you go if you haven't got access to a good wheelchair, unless you're, you know, in a well-off Indian sector, like a part of the community. So you've got, you know, I see it in Thailand all the time. They don't have access to resources. They don't have even if they've got, you know, a really great wheelchair like I've got.
Mm.
The environment, you can't go to half the places, you can't go to 90% of the places.
Is that still today, like in the it's Bangkok or a main city?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. There's a guy, Subdar, he's a guy in Bangkok, he's a wheelchair user who dedicates his life, accessibility is freedom. Bangkok access is really bad, right? And he's a strong advocate for accessibility in Thailand in general. India,
are their government taking notice
same.
Or no?
Look, they...
Because I always just think of the social structures of some of these countries, and if they respect people with disability to, you know, to really take on board their voice of, well, look at some of these other countries, like, why can't we be the same? Like, because... At the end of the day, everybody, it doesn't matter where you are on planet Earth, like, accessibility should be there, or at least, you know, taken notice of so it can help people, you know, get out and about and live life to the fullest.
Jay, it's such a big subject, yeah. And I want to remember that it was only in like the 60s. That we as Western society started to make movements towards that stuff.
Mm.
You know, America, there was a group of ex-vets and people with disabilities who camped outside the White House for months whilst the establishment fought. They just said it's going to cost too much money. We can't do that, yeah? So this is a process. It's a long.
Doesn't that make you sick?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it still makes me sick.
Right? Too much money. Still happens now.
Still all everywhere. And, I mean, it's such a complicated issue. And the West is the West, right? You know, we have kind of like, we have this kind of thing about, you know, like the colonization and the imperialist. And we see it a lot. I think it gets really negative press for good reason a lot of the times. But again, we're one of those things of all people have an intrinsic value. Yeah.
100%.
Is a very Western idea. Yeah, it's a really Western idea. So we're taking that and you're taking it into cultures where that's traditionally not the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
going back in just where you got some of these countries where wherever they're born, it's like their life trajectory is already in place for them because where they're born and the social structure, it's like you are – when you get that certain age, you're going to be this or you're going to be that.
And look, different cultures have different outlooks on disability. Right? I mean, one of the things that I was struck with when I was in India was this thing where you're wheeling around and there's people who are begging on the side of the streets or there's people who are, like, really poor or whatever. And Karan and his family were saying, no, don't help them. Because you're interfering with their karma. They're paying off a debt. So you don't help them.
They're paying off a debt.
So they're paying off a so karma, you know, like
they're born
into this existence because of bad stuff they did in a previous life. And by doing what they're doing, they'll have a better life next time. But if we interfere with it, then somehow we're interfering with their karma. Which means their next life won't be so great, right? So this – and this is – I'm not saying that all Indians think like that, but this is kind of like a traditional view of that Hindu experience is you pay off karma. Apart from that, there's a whole lot of gangs and stuff that were controlling a lot of that begging stuff. But I was really struck with that stuff. So,
yeah.
So if your culture starts with that – starts from that paradigm, then it's – pretty hard to argue for disability rights, right?
Because I've read stories about just you talking about that gangs controlling it where read, you know, true stories from places over in India and around throughout Asia where young kids get kidnapped and, you know, where they purposely disfigure some of these kids, give them a disability, and then set them up with some of these gangs like to start begging out on the streets just to gain money, you know. And I've been confronted that by, you know, when I've been to Thailand. Like this, I was able-bodied, but that was the first time me being overseas. But being in Bangkok and seeing, you'd see like 10 people that all had some form of disability and they're all there begging and asking for money and, you know, some person, they're missing their limbs and pulling themselves on like old pieces of timber, like with a few wheels on it, just trying to get along, or some that don't even have that and dragging themselves along the pavement.
And again, we live in a country where we've got, you know, it's not perfect, but we've got pretty good, like, social networks. We've got pretty good, safety nets for people who can't, who for whatever reason, can't get by. And I can speak Thai and I've made friends.
That's a hard language too because that's a tonal
so in Bangkok there's two guys that I've befriended, one who gets around on a skateboard who had stepped on a landmine over in Cambodia. And his only source of income is begging. There's another guy who I would often see just crawling along on his stomach, and we'd stop and have a chat to him. And again, he had no opportunity for that stuff, like no opportunity to get out of that. and another woman up in northern Thailand. I mean, there's a whole lot of people that I've met over the years. But this other woman up in northern Thailand who's a spinal cord injury. I remember going into this village up in far north Thailand.
Right.
It was one of the tribal groups, so Lisu or Lahu, one of those kind of tribal groups that come in from Myanmar. And there was a woman lying in a hut, and some of the locals were saying, can you go and, you know, have a look? She's kind of fell over and she broke her ankle. I mean, going in, she'd had a stroke. She'd had a stroke. She's been lying on this bed for about 2 weeks. So, you know, that kind
of
stuff.
And she had no assistance or anything.
No assistance, man. And and trying to get assistance to her was virtually impossible, right? So, again, we live in this very privileged place.
I know.
Where we have got these resources that are unbelievable.
Yeah. Right?
Absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I saw that, like, India really opened my eyes up to that, and I travelled around quite a lot.
And what's been the most confronting, that issue that you've seen with an individual, whether it's got to do with what you've just talked about now, the person with a stroke, or if it's some sort of disability or...
Yeah, I...
So it seems like you've seen a fair bit. You've travelled extensively. You've gone to 40-odd countries, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I find it hard to go past that woman with a stroke. It was...
That's full on.
It was really... It was really full on with the helplessness of it, right? We just... Like, there was nothing I could do, yeah? And there was, you know, there was virtually... So kind of sitting in this village, and I said, well, what access have you got to a doctor? And I said, oh, we're not Thai citizens. We can't get access to medical stuff. And I'm just... I kind of get haunted by her.
Like, were they classed as Burmese, like Myanmar Thai? Or what was the go? Are they floating in purgatory so they're not getting...
They're kind of floating in purgatory. So some of these tribal groups, and again, I'm not an expert on this stuff, but say the Lisu who are coming in, so the borders are kind of porous, and every now and then the Thai government will do a bit of a purge. So they'll come in and they'll settle into...
What do you mean by purge?
Yeah. So these tribal...
That word scares me, brother.
Yeah, it's a terrible word. They'll come in, say a tribal group will come into an area up in northern Thailand there.
Right.
That's unpopulated, right? So they'll kind of just set up these straw kind of huts that they live in and they'll go hunting and they'll catch what they can and they'll gradually settle into a little village, you know. You might have 40 families or something in this little village and they're just very subsistence. And then every now and then the government will go, okay, they don't own that land, we're just going to evacuate those people out of that land. So they come in, they just knock the houses down. They're just left.
What do they do with the people? They don't physically do anything to the people?
They don't do physically, or they do up in northern Myanmar. There's a lot of nasty stuff going up there with the tribal groups up there.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, the world's a harsh place.
Yeah. It was like when I was, that's reminded me of when I was in Paris, and like this is in a chair, and, that was a really accessible city. But when I been in Paris, like on the outskirts, because I was watching the news as all this was going on, and it was, you know, there was over 5,000 like gypsies living in the outskirts of Paris. And same thing, they've come in with excavators and all sorts and just, because they had all these man-made setups and like bunged up caravans and just demoed them all and just... They didn't physically do anything to the people, but it was just what they were living in, the structures, just bulldozed them down because they weren't French citizens. Like, they've travelled from here, there and everywhere. They're Romani, so, you know, it's just, it's just circumstance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, I could come at this stuff that we're just really lucky to live where we live and have the access to resources and stuff that we've got, eh?
Yeah, yeah. I know. And what's been, like, we've jumped into the dark, the hard stuff, what you've seen, and talking about some of the accessibility issues. And we've got them everywhere. Like, you know, you still get them down in bloody Sydney or the Central Coast, like in Western countries. But what's been, like, if you're going over in Asia, what's been your favourite destination ever over there when it's got to do with access or just in general?
Yeah, yeah, great question. Okay, let me kind of preface this by saying when I'm going somewhere, my kind of expectations vary. So if I'm going to Thailand, Asia, India, my expectations on accessibility are already low. Right. So I'm not going there expecting that I'm going to have perfect accessibility. Whereas if I'm going to America, I want good accessibility.
Right? Oh, yeah.
But I'd say some of the highlights for me of my travelling. Look, before I go to Asia, Charisse and I did 3 months camping in the national parks of America in 1998.
How long?
And three months.
Solid.
What
an experience.
Man, we bought an old Chevy car that was more rust than the metal. And we drove through, we did 13,000 miles in the old mile stuff in this car.
Yeah.
Just camping in national parks. We didn't, the only city we went to was Las Vegas and LA at the end. And it was just like breathtakingly beautiful and amazing experience, and we just did stuff that was fantastic. Loved it to death. And we just had a three-man tent with pretty basic stuff, right? I love Thailand. I don't know why, but I just fell in love with Thailand from the moment I got. I'll tell you why. I got to Thailand one year and I was working hard. You know, my life was really busy. I ended up in this little kind of village up in Surin through a set of circumstances and up in Isan, northeastern part of Thailand, which is particularly poor kind of region. And I didn't have internet access. I didn't have a computer. I didn't have any phones because I didn't know anyone. And I was just left with myself and what was going on around me, and I just loved it, right? So Thailand is full, like one of the most amazing places I've been to is Kanachaburi, which is where they did the Burmese railway. Prisoners of war during Second World War. But just haunting but beautiful place.
Right.
I've got another friend, Bruno, who lives over there, and I've got a block of land over there that I'm kind of selling to a Thai local at the moment. But it's out in the bush.
So you've got a block of land over there?
Yeah, yeah. It's bought under, so it's under the name of a Thai local.
Okay, because I was going to say, because I thought, like, Westerners, we can, like, own the structure, but you don't own the land. Is that correct?
Yeah, you can own a condo. You could own a condo,
right,
or something like that. But you can't. Westerners can't own land unless they've got a business or some legitimate reason,
right? Which is a business set up that's helping the locals out there. Yeah,
which is good because otherwise the price of land just goes so expensive that the locals can't afford it. Right, so it's a great rule. So I've got this block of land. So my mate's Bruno, his wife Rat. Is under her name. But where this block of land is, it's down a little bit south of Bangkok, about 3 hours south of Bangkok, near the Myanmar border, bordering on the biggest national park or state park in Southeast Asia.
Right.
And you get out there, and I tell you, it is, apart from the insects and stuff, it is the most amazing place. You could be in the jungle, the birds.
That's awesome.
Anything grows. If you leave the land for a month, it's the jungle again. It's just amazing place. I love it.
And what are you utilising when you're travelling there? Like, I'm talking equipment, manual chair. Because I've seen you utilise a freewheel, and if you want to explain that to some of the listeners and viewers.
Yeah, so when I'm travelling, there's basically my wheelchair, that device called the Free Wheel, which is just it's a really simple device. I love it. Again, a wheelchair user, a guy called Pat, just invented this really simple device. I was over in Canada. Pat was there with this, and he'd only just launched it, and I thought, we need that in Australia, right? So we started distributing it in our old company. But basically it's just, if you imagine like a big wheel on a kind of bit of a frame, and it clamps onto your wheelchair, and when the wheel of the Free Wheel is facing away from you, your front casters are on the ground.
Yeah,
and when you turn so the trailer, the wheel trails, it lifts your front casters off.
Yeah.
So now you're
because it clamps down on near your feet, yeah.
On your foot plate.
On your foot plate, yep.
So now what you've got is a really long wheelbase, so really hard to move to fall out forwards. You've got a big wheel for going over rough ground, and it's unreal. It's just like for going over grass or going down big hills or going over rocky ground, anything like that.
So you as a manual wheelchair user, like that's your go-to when you're hitting hard terrain, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the other device I travel with is the Smart Drive, which is just a portable little kind of device that powers me up amazing hills and mountains and stuff. I mean, Therese and I were in the Dolomite Mountains up in northern Italy, and just I couldn't have done that trip without the Smart Drive and the Free Wheel.
That's awesome.
And the other thing, those two things in combination also work really well. Because, I don't know.
I was going to ask you that next, if you did pair them up. So.
Yeah, I do, because the only way I ever really fall out of my chair these days is forwards, right? So I hit a crack and fall out forwards or something like that. So this Free Wheel, I would say it's virtually impossible to fall out forwards with that Free Wheel, right? You can still topple over sideways, which I've done. But falling out forwards, I can't imagine how you'd do it unless you'd went over a cliff. It's like,
yeah, right. You feel that stable and secure.
Yeah. So I've had
because even with the Smart Drive, that thing can power you along. So
it gets up to about 9 km.
That's not bad, yeah.
I've had that Free Wheel going down hills, I reckon at 30-35 km in my chair. Right?
Oh, you're giving me anxiety.
I know. It's fun, except your hands get a bit hot. So that Free Wheel in combination with the Smart Drive, it just you're not going to fall out of your chair, right? Not forwards anyway.
That's good to know, like just hearing that. But for you saying this now, so for all the listeners and viewers, like if they're going to be hitting some – if it's rough terrain here in Oz or if they feel like, you know, having a crack over in Asia or wherever it may be and it's a bit off-road, hey, let's – pair up these and you can travel all right with them when you're packing them away, yeah?
Yeah, so the Smart Drive is lithium ion, so it has to go onto the check-in with you.
Yep.
The Free Wheel, I just pack in a box and book it in. Look, the other thing is like cobblestones. I've done Europe with cobblestones without the Free Wheel and Europe with the cobblestones with the Free Wheel.
Yep.
Oh, man. Do not go over cobblestones without some of those devices. And they're just like there's so much good assistive technology out there now, like these power assist devices, like the Smart Drive, there's all sorts of front wheel attachments and all sorts of stuff going on.
Because the NDIS
has opened it up. You can actually get access to it now.
Yeah, because I've seen people, like what you're saying, cobblestones, I've seen people get locked up because the caster wheel, trying to get your front caster wheels through cobblestones.
It's hard work, I tell you.
Yeah, well, like I was in Prague
and we were in Portugal a couple of years ago. Like you chuck in cobblestones on flat ground's hard work. When you're really hilly, it's virtually impossible, right? It's just like, you don't want to know about it. Yeah.
Accessibility in Europe, favourite country? Favourite destination?
That's, look, my favourite holiday, probably my favourite holiday experience in Europe was at far northern Italy. So the Dolomites are up there.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed in this guest house, which was on top of this hill. So you had to get up. We hired a car so you could drive up this windy road. It was only like 3 Ks, but it'd take you 15 minutes because it was really windy. Mm. There was also a cable car that went from the village up to this mountain, and then you had a couple of...
Accessible, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yep.
And this guest house was perched on this hill that looked down into the valley,
mm-hmm.
and it had one of my favourite little bathrooms, because bathrooms is the critical thing for me. It's like everything else can be crap as long as the bathroom's okay.
I'm hearing you.
I had this great little bathroom, and then... Just that whole area is so stunningly beautiful. And the cable cars, you could get cable cars all over the place, right? Like, you know, the, up into the mountains and all over.
So access-wise, this place is...
Access-wise was good.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Apart from the hills. So, you know, I needed that. I couldn't have pushed up a lot of the hills that I got. But you would have a ball over there.
Yeah, great.
And the other thing I loved about that was we flew into Munich. So Germany,
yeah.
I rate Germany really highly as a place for wheelchairs and as a beautiful place as well, right? You know, the Black Forest area, Bavaria, that whole area, Munich's amazing little city. So we flew in, we stayed a few days in Munich, we hired a car, got on the Autobahn.
Hey, hold on, was this beer incentive again or
no,
what?
I don't drink. I went into drug rehab. I'm a model citizen. I don't drink.
Righto. Just had to throw that in there.
Charisse enjoyed the beer, so that's nice. So we land in there. We hire this car. We get on the Autobahn. You know, I'm like, oh, I'll get the car up to 210 Ks. That's fun. You know, but we drive from Munich down through Austria, which is just beautiful.
Yep.
End up in this Bolzano. And I'll tell you, the reason I went to Bolzano, there's a guy, Paul Craik, g'day Paul, and his wife, Danny, g'day Danny. So Paul is a wheelchair user, used to be a push bike, a really amazing guy, one of those guys that, you know, you get to know him. He was a professional push bike rider, yeah, and he'd spent time up in northern Italy, and he met his wife, Danny, was from Bolzano. So that's right. The only reason we end up in Bolzano, because we're talking to Danny and she's showing us these pictures.
Yep.
And just on Paul Craik, I'll give him a bit of a prime out there.
Shout out, Paul Craik.
Yeah, Paul. There's a stair climb, I think, the Empire State Building stair climb in New York.
Yeah.
He won it like 6 years in a row, I think. Like
that's brutal.
Before he was in a wheelchair, obviously. Paul, I dare you to win it in a wheelchair. But
drag yourself up.
Yeah. So anyway, we're in this Bolzano. We're eating great Italian food. We're in this paradise area. There's sound of music, scenery everywhere. It's just unbelievable.
What's that, you're paraplegic or?
Oh, Paul's a para.
Yeah. Para, yep.
So we had this great time in Bolzano. We spent like 10 days there, I think. And then we drove over to Hungary because one of my old work colleagues, Olivia Tomka, is Hungarian.
Ah, yeah. Olivia. Yep.
Yeah, you know Olivia. Yep. She's a great person, another wonderful person. I see, you know, you meet people in this industry and stuff. So, you know, we met up with her in Hungary and then we went up to her parents' place. They've got a place on a lake. And then we drove from Hungary along the Rhine River of Bavaria back to Munich, and we stopped at half a dozen places along there, these ancient medieval places on the Danube, as romantic as heck, beautiful, full of, you know, just amazing sort of food and stuff. So,
see, this is just good to know, brother, just the places that you've been and just making, you know, wherever they're accessible or not, but just... It's about putting awareness out there so people can hear this and go, righto, we can take this on board, learn and give it a crack and just see how it goes, you know.
So it's just before we started the podcast, I was saying I've been digitising a whole lot of our – I've just been getting a whole lot of our old photos and taking photos of them so I can actually keep them digital. And it's been a real trip down memory lane, all right?
Mm.
So you know that trips down to through America. I've been to America. I used to go there every year for work anyway.
Yep.
So I've spent a lot of time in America and Canada. I used to go to Germany every year for work as well, so Dusseldorf, but around Germany.
Yeah.
But
so you've got a lot of contacts like
Spain,
over there?
Spain, Portugal, Paris, Belgium, Amsterdam, all those places.
Like, done it
you
all.
Just go there and they're just – England, man. England is an amazing travel destination. You get to England, it's this little island, you travel 100 Ks, it changes. It's just unreal. So, and yeah, I've got tons of contacts from my wheelchair basketball, from my work. You know, up in Bolzano, there's, so not only Paul, the connection there, there's a woman that, that we worked with, Tina, and she's stationed in, she's an American, but she's stationed in northern Italy, which was, you know, an hour and a half away from where we were staying.
Yeah.
We went to Porto a couple of years ago in Portugal.
Yep.
And I get there, there's a guy, Philippe, that I used to work with, and another couple of people say, you know, Philippe's yep. local, he's showing us around. Or,
yeah.
You know, wherever I go, there's I've got a choice whether I can whether I want to contact people or not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a remarkable kind of life. It's unreal.
That's awesome. So extensive travel, lot of knowledge. It's good that you've got that, you know, like I said, for other people that, you know, if it's having a yarn with them and, you know, if it's paras or quads or – well, it doesn't matter on the disability, being a wheelchair user, you know, just getting out and about and having a crack, living life, you know, no matter your disability, having a go and just having all that knowledge and where you can pass that on and help people. But going into the work side of things, so because you've brought up some of the other colleagues that you're talking to or ex-colleagues, but how's it all going with, and I want to put a shout out to Permaville, and with yourself being a senior advisor and just an ambassador and just taking on that role, embracing it, and how is that going, and what's the future? What's pushing forward with Permaville? They're a great organisation.
So just to give a little bit of meat around that, I guess. So so 1995, up until 1995. So 2000, from 2000 to 2015, I was part owner of a business called Seating Dynamics. Chris Barks, Nick Morozov, and another guy in England were the other owners. Nick had passed away. So there was basically this business that we started with one product. We started with Rojo Distributing.
Yeah, and then I'm sitting on one of those cushions right now.
Mate, again,
thanks for coming.
I started using that product in 1982. It saved my ass for 40 odd years. You know, it's absolute. And look, so I love Rojo. I think it's a great product. But the more important thing is pressure care is really critical, right?
Super critical.
I don't care what cushion you find that works for you. Find a cushion that freaking works for you. Because when you end up with pressure injuries,
you can be out forever, you know, weeks,
you know, I
months.
I go back to 1980, I'm in hospital, right? And I'm thinking, man, life in a wheelchair, how the crap do you cope with this? And there was a guy came in who was 18 months post-injury. He had massive sores, gangrenous.
Freaks me
just
out, man.
Terrible. Yeah. And that had a really big impact on me, like a negative impact in, man, I don't want to get to that stage. Another guy comes in, Daryl Allen. Now, Daryl Allen was a funny guy, a knock-around kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage, he was 9 years post-injury. He'd been sleeping in his car. He comes in, he's got his first pressure injury, 9 years. And all the nurses are making this huge deal. Oh, 9 years without a pressure injury, how's that good? Now, 9 years was a lifetime for me as a 19-year-old. Mm. So I thought, man, if Darren can stay pressure injury-free, I can probably do it.
Good.
So that imprinted on me a positive impact. So anyway, we diverse, but, you know, knock on wood, I've been really fortunate with my skin, but yeah,
knock on wood,
take care of your freaking skin because it's
pressure care is really, central.
Yeah. So anyway, so we started off with that one central product, and over the years it grew. We were doing Tylite manual chairs, we were doing Smart Drive. We launched the Smart Drive over here. We launched Freewheel, we had Body Point. We had some really great little products, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in 2015, Permobil had started to acquire or had already acquired Tylite, Roho. They were in the throes of acquiring Smart Drive, right? And we had a good little distribution company, Seating Dynamics. So we entered into negotiations with Permobil. They ended up acquiring us, long story short.
Mm-hmm.
Headed up by a guy, Owen Dawes. Now, I cannot speak highly enough about what Owen's done mm-hmm. with that company post-acquisition. Just incredible. The company is just – the culture at the company, the staff, I don't know. Off the top of my head, I think they employ 40 to 50 people now. There's myself, there's another guy, Sergey, and Dan, who are wheelchair users. We're forever looking for wheelchair users to work in the company because we want people in chairs. And the first few years, you know, my goal, in all honesty, was to make myself redundant. Yeah, to pass over whatever skills I had, whatever knowledge I had, to make myself redundant. I had a 2-year contract with them as part of the sale. So I kind of worked hard at that, and they had such good staff, you know. On a lot of levels, they didn't need me, but I'm a wheelchair user.
Yeah,
I've got a wheelchair perspective.
That's
I've got
it.
Some knowledge of history. I've
your
got
experience.
Knowledge of stuff. So anyway, long story short, they're a great company to work with. They sell great product. They've got a great culture, and they are focused on end users.
Mm.
Yeah. Where do I see Permobil going? I think Permobil has got a vision that's really big. And they're actively pursuing it.
Agree. Yeah.
They're dedicated to good product, but more than that, they're dedicated to great service.
Yeah.
And supporting what they put out there.
Yeah.
Which is really important. So, you know, I can see. I just think it's, you know, they're bringing in stuff that's I can't share a lot of the stuff because it's their business strategies.
That's it.
But they're bringing in strategies and stuff that's just already shaken the industry up. So from my point of view, it's been a real privilege, you know, to be a part of that journey, to be a voice for the end user, I think has been nice. Nice is probably not the right word, but has been really useful for them. I don't know, sky's the limit for a company like Permobil.
Yeah, and I've seen the development too.
I think the challenge for any big company is to not get arrogant.
That's it.
Because, you know, back in the 90s, there were some pretty big companies around where people were paying to have their signs on the windows who are pretty much, you know, not relevant these days.
Yeah, and from what I see, they really, like Permobil, really take on board the user, the person in the chair, the lived experience,
the
education, the knowledge. And then that helps them as a company and help build up, help shake the tree, help mould what's going to work better for people in chairs out in the greater environment, whether it's here in Oz or wherever it may be around the world. And especially talking about around the world, when you've been here, there and everywhere, that's just adding ammo to what they've already got. So, and shout out to Owen because, you know, I've seen from, you know, when I knew him like a decade ago to where he's at now and just where that's all built. And it's amazing.
It is amazing. And the whole, like, I think what, you know, his cast of vision, I don't want to piss in his pocket too much, you know, his cast of vision, and part of that vision has been to get great people involved in the company.
Yeah.
So they build the culture, yeah.
That's it.
And that stuff on clinical training, again, we've got in Australia, Rachel and Tracy Lee, who are just so knowledgeable. And when they're doing their clinical training, it's not about product. It's about best outcomes for people, you know. It's about best outcome for therapists, OTs, and for end users. And that's, you know, that's, it's again, for me, that's a sign of a really good company when their clinical education is not about selling product, it's about informing and enabling and equipping. Yeah.
Spot on, brother. Righto. Love that. We're getting to the end, but before we wrap it up, I've pinched three photos off your social media. I want you to explain this stuff. Righto.
Okay.
Hold tight.
Oh, I'm a bit nervous now.
Good.
What have you found?
Good. Nothing incriminating, maybe.
Oh, good.
Wait up. Come on. Where are we? Where are we? We'll start with this one first. This is going to flip around. Righto, take me time.
Ah, lucky rich.
Explain this to the listeners out here. Who's his fella and what's going on?
Oh, Lucky, I hope you're watching this, Lucky. So Lucky Rich is, man, he is one of my favourite characters in the world. We don't see each other a lot, but when we do, it's just fantastic. So I first met Lucky, I was in England, playing wheelchair basketball, and Lucky is in the Guinness Book of Records as the most tattooed man in the world, yeah?
Right.
Anyway, he's a street performer, so he does, you know, flame eating and gets up on a big monocycle and wheels around and does all sorts of juggling and stuff.
He swallow swords and all that carry on too.
Oh, a remarkable guy. So through some mutual acquaintances, we hooked up in London. And, you know, I don't know. It was just one of those, for whatever reasons, we just like, oh, man, we really like each other, yeah?
Yeah.
So we just became friends. And that photo there, I think I took at a convention down in Sydney, and I hadn't seen him for a few years. And, again, we just like, we saw each other and went, oh, man. We just went straight back to London and supporting each other through some pretty hard times we were going through at that stage and all that kind of stuff. So that's Lucky Rich, great guy. I hope I catch up with him soon because, he's just one of those characters that you meet in life. And
that's awesome.
That's unreal. I like the fringes.
Yeah, that's it. Righto. Let's go next one. Not that way, this way. Righto.
Okay.
Trophied up.
Trophied up. Ah, so this is me playing with the wheelchair roller hawks.
Roller hawks. Where is that? Over here, overseas.
Shellhaven. So Shell Harbour. So this was the Sydney. This was the Australian national basketball league, the National Wheelchair Basketball League. This was a really special year. We had a guy from Canada, Joey Johnson. Out playing in our team. The best player in the world was another Canadian guy, Paddy Anderson, who's a double amp, who was playing with the Brisbane team.
Right.
So another guy, Troy Sachs, who's an Australian guy, who is a phenomenal. He changed the game. In his day, he was the best wheelchair basketball, changed the way wheelchair basketball was played. So we're over here. We've got Joey Johnson and a pretty strong team around. I played every minute of the final games in that that year. Winning the National League is really hard. We were up against Paddy Anderson and the Brisbane team, who were a really good squad. And anyway, we won it. So that's just me with the trophy from the National League that year. It was a really special year. And that was the first time that the Rollerhawks had won that title.
Yeah, nice.
They've gone on and won it a few times since. But, yeah, that was a really – it was a great year. And Joey Johnson is one of – again, talking about lovely guys. He was this Canadian guy who was a great wheelchair basketball, but more than that, just a great human being. That's a real good team guy.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a quick story, right?
Yeah. Go.
I'm in Germany in Düsseldorf, right, at a trade show, and they've got three of the top wheelchair basketball players there doing a little bit of a show in during one of the sessions. Yeah. So I got Paddy Anderson, this other guy whose name I won't be able to pronounce,
yeah,
and Joey Johnson, and they're doing these things. But at one stage, Paddy Anderson with this other guy, they've got their chair on one wheel, right? So they're balanced with only one wheel on the ground. And they're taking the other wheel off and they're kind of playing juggles with each other, right?
Yeah, right.
And Joey's just sitting in there watching it. And I wheeled up to Joey and I said, "Hey, Joey, what's going on? How come you aren't doing it?" He said, "Oh, that's just for show ponies, mate." That's just really, yeah. That was a great Joey Johnson quote.
Just putting it on, right, eh?
Yeah.
Okay. Where are you and what's going on in this rural remote situation?
Yep.
Explain where you are and what's going on, brother.
So this is Thailand.
You're free-wheeled up to.
Yeah. So this is Thailand. Remember the land I was talking about that I've got and my friend Bruno has got?
Oh, is this it?
We are looking at Bruno's land right there.
Right.
He was building that little bungalow and I said, "Hey, can you make it wheelchair accessible? I'll pay for the ramp and stuff on it." So this is not long after it's been built. This place, so there's a river. Mm-hmm. In the back, like Thailand has, like the jungle has all sorts of weird insects, right? And one of the things they have over there is they're like a giant centipede and they've got these nippers on them.
Yeah, God.
And they reckon if they bite you, it's one of the worst bites you can get. Like you'll be in pain for a month to 6 weeks. Right?
Far out. It's just ongoing.
It's ongoing. Oh, yeah.
Jesus, right.
So that little place there is paradise. Just unreal. Love it to death. You've got hornbill. That place, they've got hornbills coming down playing on
the birds, deck. Hornbills. Yeah. Yep.
They'll come down, they play out the front of that freaking place. I mean, every hair on my body kind of stood up when I saw them the first time. But I'm in this bathroom. You know what it's like? You're in the bathroom and I'm sitting on this little portable chair that I travel with. And all of a sudden there's one of those big centipedes and they travel about a million miles an hour. And I'm in this bathroom watching this thing. And I'm just thinking, man, I'm trying to lift my legs up so it can't get me. So yeah. Anyways, that's the land. It's inland from – it's about – oh, sorry. So it's inland from Hua Hin towards Myanmar.
Right.
The first time I went up there was for my mate Bruno wedding. So we're travelling up there early in the morning through this mist. And on the side of the road there's these signs going – "Do not feed the elephants." I mean, who's going to freaking feed a wild elephant, right? So we come around this corner and there's an elephant.
Yeah, because you can get a charge down and you go on.
There's an elephant standing in the middle of the road.
Right.
We stop the van. The guy puts his puts the van in reverse just in case. And it's this misty, beautiful morning. So we have this standoff. And then eventually the elephant walks to the edge of the jungle. We drive past and he lets out the big elephant call, you know.
And, to try and scare it off sort of thing or what?
Yeah. So in it just on the edge of the road as we're driving past, there's his partner, the female, with a little baby elephant, yeah. So he lets out this giant
yell. What do you call
it? It was just beautiful. Yeah. So, you know, that's the kind of environment that's up there. You've got these you've got wild elephants roaming around. You've got the pineapple farmers letting off bombs at night to scare the elephants off.
Yeah.
You're kind of asleep going, "Hey, And poof, we say, hey, what's that noise? Oh, it's the farmers.
Yeah, well, you don't bombs. Yeah, well, that's it. You don't want to meet in your bloody, you know, your produce that you're growing out there.
Absolutely.
So is that going to retire or what?
Elephants aren't dumb, man. No, the smart. Pineapples are up there are to die for. No, I'm not going to retire up there. I'm really happy where we are on Lake Macquarie. It's beautiful. I'd like my life from you know what my vision for retirement is to find some way again that I can be a service in my local community,
yep.
And to just enjoy that. I want to find out more about the Awabakal people, so maybe you can point me in some.
100%.
Directions there, because I want to know more about our Indigenous culture, and I want to know more about our land in Australia. And, you know, going back to that travel stuff, Australia's great. You don't have to go. Like, New Zealand's great, yeah?
There's plenty in the backyard here.
If going overseas is intimidating, yeah, go up to the Barrington Tops, go up to Dorrigo Rainforest, go. You know, do a trip somewhere in Australia. It's awesome.
Yeah.
So that's what I want to do. I want to, I've kind of, as I'm getting older, I realise that my sphere of influence is not that great. So there's a certain, you know, I've got a sphere of influence and it's pretty local. And if I can be a positive wheel print on my local community,
wheel print,
then I'm pretty happy with that, you know.
Mate, you have got a massive spear that's got a lot of reach, and where you can utilise that, you know, in the local community. It's just that experience that you've built up over the years, whether it's been overseas or anywhere, there's a lot of stuff you can utilise over here. And, you know, if that's going to help you, but help other people out there that are in chairs or that aren't in chairs, you know, just local businesses or just local knowledge, you know, whatever it may be. But much appreciated. But before we wrap it up, did you want to give any shout outs or throw out any social media handles, or if people wanted to get in contact with you, or just throw it out there?
Interesting. Mate, get in touch with me through Permabil is probably the best way. I'm kind of being an addictive personality, Facebook can be a real distraction for me. So I'm kind of trying to be really disciplined with my Facebook time. But look, I'm an open book. I'm happy to have a chat with anyone about stuff. Happy to give my experiences. So I reckon the best idea is to just get in touch with me through Permabil. And yeah, I'm happy to have a chat or just, you know, talk about stuff or whatever. Yeah. It's probably the best way to do it, yeah.
Malcolm, much appreciated, brother. You heard the man, wealth of experience. He's wheeled across the land. He's got a long spear to wield. So you know where to get in contact with him through Permabil. But, yeah, really appreciate the time that you've just taken just come down here, just having an open, honest conversation, just telling it how it is. And and you know, that's going to resonate with a lot of people out in the greater field, and you know, people with disabilities or not, brother. So much appreciated.
Thanks, Eats, mate, and thanks for the work you're doing, because I know you're pretty dedicated to this cause as well. So not pretty dedicated, very dedicated to this cause. So good on you. Yeah.
Just having a crack, brother.
Yeah.
Righto.
Good on you, mate.
Cheers, brother.
Thanks. Thanks, Jake.
Beauty. See, folks, Mr. Malcolm Turnbull. The knowledge and experience that he's learnt through his spinal cord injury, with assistive tech, the businesses, the travel, and the accessibility within all of that, how he's balanced it, and that wealth of knowledge where it helps people like myself and other mob in chairs, but also occupational therapists and other people involved with spinal cord injuries, as in the professions. Because they learn from the users, the people in chairs, that adds to what they know, what they learn. And then that helps people with spinal cord injuries going through the systems of what they need to know to move forward in life. There's a lot of professionals in and out of chairs that can help you. So reach out, have a yarn. These people exist, they're out there. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at Street Rolling Cheetah or email one word, straightrollingcheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.